From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North. Today on the show, the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel's Tom Dakin reports on the efforts to restore some of Milwaukee's movie palaces.
The idea is one thing, the romance is one thing, the cost is quite another. They tend to be, like a lot of historic building renovation projects, very expensive.
Then a local event features a display of Jesus, Mary, and Joseph detained in an ICE facility. Essayist Mel Miskimmin wonders if she's becoming too callous. And dining critic Ann Christensen shares one of her favorite outdoor dining spots.
It's a really nice kind of double-deck patio that's right on the water and just a beautiful spot as the sun is coming down. I think that's like a gorgeous spot to watch the sunset. And as you go up and down the river right there, there are other spots that have some patios like the Ale House, you know. But there's just something about Blue Bats that I really like.
Lake Effect comes your way next. News is first. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks so much for tuning in today. I'm Bonnie North. In the 1910s and 20s, Americans fell in love with a new art form, the motion picture. In cities throughout the country, extravagant movie palaces were built, which generally featured a single screen and included a stage for vaudeville acts. As multi-screen movie theaters came on the scene in the 1960s and 70s, these ornate palaces began to close and fall into disrepair. Over the past two decades, many of these old spaces have been brought back to life as atmospheric theaters and music venues, but each project comes with a hefty price tag. Tom Dakin covers commercial development for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. He joins Lake Effect's Joy Powers to talk about some of the efforts to revitalize these century-old movie palaces and restore them to their former glory.
Being a larger metropolitan area, we have a lot of historic movie theaters because that's the way we used to do movies. I mean, your grandparents didn't generally go to multiplex cinemas. That was an innovation that occurred, or a curse if you prefer, started in roughly the 1960s and then really started expanding with mall cinemas, et cetera. So obviously you had smaller theaters, more of them, versus the current general business model of having fewer theaters but screens all clustered together. That's number one. Number two, Milwaukee's generally done a pretty good job of not knocking down historic buildings. So they're there. And people like historic theaters. I mean, people have good feelings about them. Even people our age who generally didn't go to these types of theaters, they at least like the idea. Now, the problem is the idea is one thing, the romance is one thing, the cost is quite another. They tend to be, like a lot of historic building renovation projects, very expensive. And the ones that are currently in various stages of development right now in Milwaukee and the surrounding communities, some of those might not happen because the cost barrier is so high.
When we're looking at, you know, the Grand, the Warner Grand, I guess I should say, there are other theaters called Grand that kind of up for the same kind of project. We've talked about this before, but what are they doing over at the Warner Grand? Because it's a huge project.
Yeah. I mean, it's going to have a really big impact on downtown, specifically on the west side of downtown. As a matter of fact, I dare say it's going to have as big an impact as the Avenue, the redevelopment of the Grand Avenue into the Avenue. Well, what's happening is MSO is spending $89 million to restore that beautiful, beautiful building and turn it into their performance center. They tore down a building next to it that was last a sushi restaurant, and they're building a very attractive addition to it. And it's going to be a nice blend of the historic architecture with the newer design. And it's going to be their performance center, rehearsal center. They're going to try – well, I think they will have their offices in there. They have talked about eventually redeveloping some of the upper levels of that office building that's attached to the old theater. It's all part of the same complex, but that's a little more off in the future. But yeah, it's going to have a tremendous impact on the west side of downtown, I mean, especially when you consider a few years ago what it was like walking down West Wisconsin Avenue or driving down West Wisconsin Avenue. That was a dead zone, that area. And that particular property really contributed to it because it was so large and so vacant for such a long time. Good news is Marcus Corporation did a great job of maintaining the property. Now some of these theaters have not been maintained well. That one was maintained very, very well. And fortunately, that did help make converting it easier than it would otherwise be.
I mean, it was maintained well, but still $89 million. Of course, they're doing a lot of big things there.
Right.
I mean, they're moving a whole wall to make the,
right,
space bigger,
yeah,
which I'm sure contributes to that quite a bit.
Right. And historic renovations, I mean, they will get state and federal historic preservation tax credits to defray some of those expenses. But you accept the credits, you follow the standards, and the standards are meticulous. And the National Park Service, which runs that program, they don't mess around. You follow their rules to a T, and then you get your credits. So, yeah.
Yeah. So looking at a different grand theater, and this isn't really even in a proposal state, it doesn't seem like yet, but there is a group that's trying to preserve another grand theater.
Right. The mini grand, the little grand. The Grand Theater up on Holton Street in the Harambee neighborhood on Holton, right on the border of River West and Harambee. It's on Holton just about a block or so north of Locust. That theater has been closed, I think, since like maybe mid to late 70s, if I had to guess. Certainly before my time, it shut down. And there's a group of residents who live in that neighborhood called the River West Investment Cooperative. And about a year ago, they got an option from the city, purchase option, to control the property while they tried to raise money to convert it into their idea was just to try and create maybe a live venue for performing arts. River West and Harambee both have a lot of musicians living there, and they thought, hey, it'd be nice to have a little bit bigger venue than what we currently have, and that's the effort that's going on there. I'm not sure that they've – how far they've progressed on that, frankly, but that's one proposal that's out there. There's sort of a somewhat similar proposal that's moved further along, and it's probably more visible, and that's the new State Theater, and that's the project on a State Street just east of North 27th. And that's probably better known to most of your listeners because up until the early 90s, that was actually a working tavern. Throughout the 80s and into the 90s, it was a club that hosted a lot of rock musicians. I mean, and these were people who were not really famous yet. They were playing relatively small venues, but, you know, let's go see Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers for $5 or whatever. I mean, it was that kind of place. And then it shut down, reopened as a strip club, did so under pretenses that the Common Council thought were deceptive, so they didn't get their license renewed, and then it just closed for good. But it's been sold to a group as of the end of last year, and they have been raising money to convert it. So that at least has progressed to the point of it being bought by this nonprofit group. They do have people involved who have good experience with development. One's a neighborhood developer who's done one or two smaller projects in the area. They have an architect involved who's well known for design. So that one's kind of moving along right now at this point. And the catch there is it would be a music venue. It would be an all-ages music venue, which is something that we hear repeatedly is needed in Milwaukee. Part of the problem running an all-ages music venue is it's all ages because, you know, you can't serve alcohol. So how do you make your money when you run that venue and you're not serving alcohol? That does make the economics of it a little tougher, but these folks have a business plan, and some of it involves also, I think, leasing space to various music-oriented businesses, like someone running a studio, for example, sound engineer would be in there. So they're trying to move that one forward, and they have at least taken one step with actually buying the property.
You know, we were talking about historic spaces especially. How old are most of these spaces?
Oh, gosh. Well, let's see. The new State, or what was called the State Theater, the Grand Theater up on Holton, I think those might both date back to the teens or the early 20s. The Warner Grand Theater, that may have had the misfortune of opening in 1929. Ooh. Not the best of years to be opening a big new business, but I have that fixated in my brain, so I think that's correct. We haven't talked yet about the Modjeska Theater, which also is in a stage of kind of moving forward. I mean, there's been some work done, actually quite a bit of work done, just gutting all the junk out of the interior. And it's just been sort of waiting for either a theater operator or some other type of commercial use to come along to then do the additional expensive work of converting it. But the Modjeska would have opened 20s or maybe late teens. So yeah, these are all quite old. Yeah.
These are almost, if not a century old at this point.
Right, yeah.
What kind of things happen over a century, especially, I mean, you mentioned that the Warner Grand was very well kept, but a lot of these spaces have been empty a long time.
Yeah, yeah. And the biggest problem when you get a building that shuts down and it's shuttered and empty, I mean, two big problems. If you get a hole in the roof like what you had on the State Theater, for example, that's pretty dire. You start getting water in there. And the State Theater, your listeners might recall a few years ago, there was a fire that caused damage. And so that was kind of an emergency situation that if you're going to preserve the building, you got to move pretty quickly on that because you don't want holes. I mean, water starts getting in, turns into ice during the winter. You get animals in there. You can get people in there, too, and cause problems as well. Set it up for mischief and various bad things. So that kind of stuff happens. If you're not heating the building, which in some cases, you know, there's no longer a furnace that's operating in there, that's bad. I mean, you can get water in. It freezes. It expands, contracts. That can, cause real problems to your building.
Well, a lot of these spaces are going to have something that a modern theater or a modern movie theater likely doesn't have in the same way. They're going to have stages for vaudeville acts.
Well, yeah, live performance. I mean, that's the idea, obviously, with both the Grand on Holton, the Grand downtown, the State on State. We haven't mentioned West Bend Theater, which is literally right now going through its approval process with the Plan Commission, although they've already started some of the work there, the interior work. Up in downtown West Bend, the idea in most of these is to create live venues. Maybe have some limited movie showings. I know at the West Bend Theater they're going to show some movies, but you know, live performances and other events too. You know, weddings, corporate meetings, that kind of stuff that lends itself. I mean, the people doing these projects, in some cases they may be a bit idealistic, but they're not stupid. They know they can't compete against AMC and Marcus for regular release movies. They're not even going to try and do that.
I think about, of course, like I live down in Bayview and we have the Avalon down
theater.
There. And a lot of what they do, they show movies, but mm-hmm. they show movies that have been out for a while.
Right, right. Yeah, and that's one way you can do it. You can get your second run movies, do it for a lower price than what you would do if it were first run. I think the Avalon has a pretty well-known restaurant as part of that operation. I know Lee Barzak, the man who runs that operation, has done other restaurants in the Milwaukee area. So yeah, that's one way you can do it. And I will say this, the thing about the Avalon is some of these theaters are quote unquote atmospheric theaters. So they do have that ability to compete by offering you something different that you don't get at a typical multiplex. Well, that's what people love about the Oriental Theater, for example. It's a great atmospheric movie palace that people aren't just going there to see a movie. They are, but they're also going there because you have this cool vibe to the whole building, both inside and outside.
Well, so. And the Oriental is doing its own renovations.
Right. I've written a little bit less about that. My colleague Chris Foran has written a ton about it. He's the expert on that stuff. But they're doing the needed renovations. You know, and that raises an interesting question. What about the Downer? Because before Milwaukee Film, the nonprofit group, took over the operation of the Oriental, the Oriental and Downer were both operated by Landmark Cinemas, which is the country's largest art house circuit based out of Los Angeles. And I had conversations years prior to that about the Downer with Ted Mundorf, who is then the president of Landmark, saying, you know, gee, it's normally we don't like to be in a market this size with just two theaters that have a combined, I think it might be six screens. In other words, they want more screens. Well, now they're down to the Downer Theater, which has, I think, two or three screens. It truthfully raised the question in my mind as to whether Landmark really wants to continue to operate the Downer and whether there's an opportunity there for another operator, I don't know, maybe Milwaukee Film or whomever, to take over that theater at some point.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So we talked about the Oriental a bit, the Grand Theater in River West, the Warner Grand Theater, and the historic West Bend Theater. Now, they just released a whole proposal. And I don't know if there's an exact answer to this question, but what is the timeline for these kinds of projects? Because it seems like, you know, they're picked up and some of them just kind of dissipate. Mm-hmm. Others, it seems like an incredibly difficult process, in part because of the historic nature of these buildings.
Right.
But also just the fun. So we're looking at a proposal for the West Bend Theater right now.
Yeah, that one's actually moving along. They the group there, it's called Historic West Bend Theater. It's a nonprofit group. People living in West Bend who wanted to preserve that building, they bought that building Let's see, it would have been in 2017. And by the end of last year, by the end of 2018, they were starting to do the interior, kind of the interior gutting. And so they've been raising funds. They've been doing work as they go along. They're at the point now where the reason they're going to the Plan Commission this week in West Bend is because they need the Plan Commission's approval for the exterior work that they're now planning to do. But they've actually already taken care of some pretty significant expenses there. They've taken care of the lead paint. They've taken care of the asbestos. Those are always probably your two biggest environmental concerns. And they've thrown out all the old seats. I think they had initially hoped to salvage some of them, but it was beyond repair, and they tossed all those out. So they're moving along. They hope to have the West Bend Theater they hope to have their soft opening, honestly, by the holidays, by the Christmas holidays. New State over on the near west side on State Street, I don't know that there's a specific timeline there yet. Ditto with the Holton Street Grand Theater, which is probably the least furthest along of everything we've been talking about. Modjeska, as I mentioned earlier, they've done a fair amount of the interior demolition gutting work. They're kind of, I think, actively looking for a user, and who knows, maybe they'll have something pop there soon. And then, of course, the downtown Warner Graham Theater, that's going to be open by next fall of 2020. That's where MSO will be performing as of September of 2020.
All right. Well, I look forward to seeing all of these spaces.
Yeah, yeah.
I think they should be fun.
Yeah, it should be.
Well, Tom, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect and sharing your work.
Thanks, Joy.
Tom Dakin covers commercial development for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. He regularly joins us to talk about real estate. Today, he spoke with Lake Effect's Joy Powers. We'll take a short break and then meet one of the organizers behind a local event that features a display of Jesus, Mary, and Joseph detained in an ICE facility. We'll learn more when Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee's NPR. We are back with more of Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Bonnie North. The crisis at the U.S.-Mexico border may seem far away, but for many Milwaukeeans, it hits close to home. That's why Latinx community members have come together for an event tonight in solidarity with the Close the Camps movement. The event will feature a nativity scene surrounded by fencing to draw parallels between the Holy Family and migrants detained in border facilities. Julio Guerrero is the founder of Milwaukee Taco Truck Advocates, one of the organizers of the event. He spoke with Lake Effect's Joy Powers about his group and their decision to hold the event.
There's all this stuff in the news about what's happening at the border. You know, you're seeing articles right and left about abuse in detention centers and families being separated from their children. I remember the day that photo was released of the father with his daughter holding her in his T-shirt. And they had drowned in the river on their way to this country. The issue of immigration reform or just folks in detention centers doesn't really affect me personally. I'm third generation. You know, my family's been here for a long time. But I will say I think what really motivated me to want to kind of do something around this issue was I have friends that are undocumented that have worked with me on the taco truck events that we do. One of the last times I hung out with a good friend of mine, we were having dinner, we were having coffee, and she's like, yeah, you know, I'm technically undocumented. And there are certain times a day that I don't even go out and drive because I don't have my current license plate sticker. And I'm worried if I get pulled over that I might get deported. You know, I have friends that kind of live in that fear every day. Every day it's on their mind that something could happen to me. I could get pulled over for speeding. I could get pulled over by a cop or racially profiled by police, and that might be it for me. I might be sent back to a country that I don't even know. And it was just kind of like that was the impulse to want to try and do something here in Milwaukee. Now, just by circumstance, we have the LULAC National Convention here this week. Also, randomly, we found out like last week that President Trump is also going to be in town on Friday. You know, so there's this huge like convergence of things happening. And then also, too, you know, I think it's tonight, Thursday night at the LULAC convention. They're having the presidential debate with the Democratic candidates. And I think early this morning, Elizabeth Warren came out and said, you know, under a Warren administration, there would be accountability for ICE and Border Patrol agents that were accused of physical or sexual assault of the migrants being detained. At the end of the day, you know, we have President Trump, and he sets the tone. He creates the culture under which all of these things are happening to migrant families, to the Latinx community. And I always like to think about when I was growing up, my mom would say, you can't leave it up to other people to fight your own battles for you. And that's kind of where my head is at. I think that would I like to focus on other issues relevant to the Latinx community, like better education, better access to healthcare, those sorts of things? Absolutely. But at the same time, you can't ignore that President Trump is kind of – he's exploiting our community in order to motivate and inspire his base of supporters. And he's trying to score political points at our expense. And literally, it's not just about political points. I mean, 13 or 15 people at least and counting have died in custody of ICE and Border Patrol. You know, so we have to address it. We have to do something to say, you know, what's happening is wrong. We need to do better. We can do better. And that's kind of what led to the idea of doing like a display, a nativity scene being detained by ICE.
Yeah, it's a very specific way to respond. And you know, your organization isn't religious, but you have collaborated with another religious organization. Mm-hmm. Why did you choose the nativity scene, the creche?
A lot of the people that support President Trump and his policies identify as Christian, and they're very proud of it. And then it kind of leads to a conversation of, well, what does it mean to be a Christian? And I've been kind of losing sleep over that this week because I grew up Catholic and I haven't considered myself a person of faith for a long time. But that's because I grew up in a very conservative church where I felt that there wasn't alignment between what was the story of Jesus in the Bible and then the fact that every time I went to church, I was being told who was going to go to hell. And so I thought, man, this doesn't really line up for me. This doesn't make sense. And I think anytime you do anything with Jesus or religious themes, it's really important to kind of make sure that you're not being offensive. We want to be provocative, like we know it's going to inspire critique. But at the same time, the goal is not to just make people angry for the sake of making them angry. The goal is to inspire thoughtfulness and a conversation and to challenge people to say, you know, if we look at the story of Jesus and the Holy Family and how they were fleeing violence from King Herod, does that kind of correlate to the migration story of all these families that are coming through the border because they're fleeing the violence and the persecution of their governments in Central America or the drug cartels? You know, so I'm not a religious person. And so it's important for me as we're kind of tackling a bit of a religious theme to have partners in doing this that have that religious space to then inform and educate me so that we're doing something that is, you know, productive.
Productive and both respectful of Christianity, mm-hmm. and the biblical Jesus, right?
Right.
So when you look at the story of Jesus and when you look at what's happening at the border, what do you see as the kind of themes that tie these things together?
Well, I mean, I think for me, and again, I guess I'm, what would they call a Catholic who doesn't go to church anymore?
cultural Catholic?
Yeah, cultural Catholic. I guess I would say, you know, when I think of Jesus, I think of stories about healing the sick, feeding the poor, doing miracles, and he talked with lepers.
Welcoming the stranger.
Right. And so there was a lot of this sense of like, Jesus was an advocate for the least among us, right? And so when I think about that and I think about, you know, what's happening at the border today to, you know, parents that are being separated from their kids and kids being lost in the system and there not being a way for parents to find where their children are being detained, stories of sexual assault and abuse that are happening to children that are being detained by people that work for our government, you know, Border Patrol, ICE officials, these don't strike me as being things that if they were happening in Jesus' time, that he would rubber stamp. And that's why I think that it's important to speak out because we have a president that I think is kind of giving a rubber stamp to the behavior and he's not addressing the moral ramifications of the existing policy. So I would like this to be a situation where we didn't have to talk about this issue. That would be my preference, right? But this is an issue that that is kind of in our face. And so I believe that we have to address it head on. We can't ignore it. And then we all, and then I think for the Latinx community, you know, candlelight vigils are great, protests are great, demonstrations are great. But at the end of the day, Donald Trump got into office because people voted him into office. And as I'm navigating other community stakeholders in the Latinx community, I really believe that it's important to say, if we want something different, we have to do something different. And what I mean by that is, if we don't want to have politicians like Donald Trump making decisions that negatively affect our community, we have to start voting better people into office. And I'm not saying voting is the only solution, because I've never believed that, but I believe that it's a big part of the solution. And so that's my hope, you know, for our community here in Milwaukee, that, you know, we can have better elected officials, and then we can have the power to hold them accountable by saying, hey, if we elect you and we put you into power and then you don't deliver on the promises that you've made to our community, we're going to vote you out and we'll replace you. And to me, that's real power.
Yeah. And making it about accountability as opposed to party allegiance, which often is how these kinds of things are framed.
Right. Absolutely.
You know, you talked about this a little bit, but I think for us here in Wisconsin, the U.S.-Mexico border feels like it's a world away. And yet so many people in our community, the issues that are going on at the border are also the issues that they're dealing with here. Mm. What does this kind of project do for the people who are afraid?
You know, I went to a Voces de la Frontera event last year, and I heard one of my friends chanted undocumented and unafraid. And then I talked to her about that after that dinner, and I asked her, you know, what does that mean to you? And she told me that, you know, she said it out loud in that room, almost like trying to convince herself that she is unafraid, because the reality is that she lives her day every day afraid, and that it is scary. I think what we can do, people like myself and other community stakeholders that, you know, that are citizens, that we have that privilege, is we can leverage our resources, and we can leverage the things that we can put together to say, this is not a fight that you're going to have to fight alone, that we're going to be in solidarity with you. We're going to stand right by your side, because that whether you're undocumented or you're not undocumented, if you're not undocumented and you're a member of the Latinx community, you know someone that is. That's just a fact. So I would hope that by taking a stand on these issues and by having events like these, and hopefully we're helping them feel more resolute that this is something that we can win. And we may not win it, you know, this month or this year, but maybe 2020, you know, and maybe we don't get it together by 2020. And that's a reality. It's very unlikely that presidents don't get reelected historically. Maybe it takes until 2024. But if you look at the whole Democratic slate of presidential candidates and how the conversation has shifted, where things that were considered to be progressive or radical 4 years ago are now being absorbed by all the candidates, whether that's immigration reform or education reform, it's very inspiring to see that the needle has shifted quite a bit in a short amount of time. And you know, again, we're focusing on the immigration issue because that's the issue that's affecting our community the most. And it's the issue that, you know, President Trump seems to want to dig his heels into at our expense. So we have to stand up to that, and we have to fight back.
Well, Julio, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect and sharing your work.
Thank you so much. It was great to be here.
Julio Guerrero is the founder of Milwaukee Taco Truck Advocates, a group of Latinx community members working for economic and racial justice in Milwaukee. Guerrero spoke with Joy Powers. Milwaukee Taco Truck Advocates are collaborating with Zao MKE Church and All People's Church for an event tonight in Silver City. You can find more information at wuwm.com. we get used to things. It could be a squeaky hinge on a door that we just don't hear anymore, or the way we automatically dodge the edge of a counter that sticks out just a little too far. As Lake Effect essayist Mel Miskimmin works on her house, she wonders if she's become too laid back.
I was in the upstairs front bedroom stripping the 1880s walls of 1980s wallpaper. It was a Saturday morning. The neighborhood was in the process of waking itself up, figuring out the plan for the rest of the day. And then, pop, 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 gunshots. Close enough for me to hear the ping, ping, ping of spent cartridges hitting the pavement. So what did I do? Grab my phone? Call 911? No. I moved the ladder, put on latex gloves, and continued my assault on Laura Ashley's thistle pattern. I hadn't heard any follow-up volleys, no screaming, no squealing tires, nothing that would have required my immediate attention. If it hadn't been for the 15-minute waiting period for the wallpaper dissolving solution to take effect, I wouldn't have gone outside to see if maybe there might be anything. I grabbed a plastic bag in case the perp was still out there, thinking they would think I wasn't looking for anything incriminating, just litter, when the police pulled up and started taping off the street. The officers moved at a pace that didn't belie any urgency. You want to know what the shocking part was? Not the fact there was a shooting or that the victim had called 911 and driven themselves to the hospital, but that the police department allowed man buns. Officer Manbun took notes on what I had seen and heard. I told him the exact number of shots, gave a description of a car, the occupants. Unfortunately, it had had no plates. He complimented me on my observational skills. I told him I had been trained from an early age to notice distinguishing marks, remember license plate numbers, because my father had been a police officer. Oh, he said, where? Milwaukee, I said, 40 years. Wow, he said. Indeed, I said. I had been working on a project and had my father's old police notebooks from the 50s and 60s. I ran inside, grabbed a few, gave them to Officer Manbun. He chuckled as he read the accounts of knife fights, foul language, drunks, kids throwing rocks. He sighed, seems almost quaint. I brought up the 1960s and 70s when I was a teenager and my father was the man, definitely not quaint. Must have been interesting, he said. I'd have gone with difficult, I said. Apparently the shooting had been an old boyfriend versus new boyfriend kind of drama. Words had been exchanged before the shots had been fired. Yeah, they unfortunately used the same drug dealer and that's how they both ran into each other. Awkward, I said. I hate when that happens. They had pretty much wrapped up their investigation, the crime scene no longer taped off. I went back to my task, peeling wallpaper off the walls in large pieces, like sunburned skin from my husband's back, as if nothing had happened. Because I guess that's where we are now.
Lake Effect essayist Mel Miskimmin is the author of Cop's Kid and Sit, Stay, Heal. She lives in Milwaukee. We will take one last break and then chat with Milwaukee Magazine's dining critic Ann Christensen about some of her favorite places to eat outside in the summertime. Lake Effect returns with that in a moment on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Lake Effect continues now on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Bonnie North. Now that the warm weather is finally here, lots of people are taking advantage of it. From backyard projects to exercise, it seems as if everyone in the greater Milwaukee area is putting on sunblock and getting outside. One of our favorite ways to celebrate the summer is by dining al fresco. Restaurants put tables on the sidewalks, and long enclosed patios are opened up and filled up by hungry patrons eager to enjoy the food and the fresh air. Senior editor and dining critic Ann Christensen wrote the cover story in this month's Milwaukee Magazine, The Ultimate Guide to Summer Dining from Patios to Rooftops to Sidewalks. She tells Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski what makes a good spot for outdoor dining.
I was looking mostly at just incredible outdoor spaces. So, yes, I think comfortable seating. I mean, it doesn't have to be like plush seating, but comfortable enough. Yes, some shade absolutely is necessary. I think having some kind of visual treatment, whether it's landscaped, there are trees nearby, something that gives it, or, you know, like an outdoor fire pit. I mean, little amenities that add some kind of element of extra fun or just a little more aesthetics to it. Those are things I was looking for. I think also the idea of the kind of place that you could see bringing out-of-towners going with a large group of people because, again, it has just such an energy to it. And then, I mean, this is another thing unto itself that I get into, but the patios then that have a view, you know, whether it's a water view, it could be the river, it could be the lake, or it could be a space that's on top of a building. So there you have like this incredible sky that you're looking up to. So I was looking at all those things, and those are important. I mean, I think sometimes you can have a lot of fun at a table that's just right outside the door of the restaurant.
Well, and I've noticed a lot of restaurants have this very economical way of maybe transforming their existing space into, quote, an outdoor space with the use of garage doors at front. So do you still consider that like, hey, this is still outdoor dining if it's just, all right, we got the doors open and a breeze is coming in?
I think there has to be seating outside the doors for that to happen. So, for instance, when you say that, I think of Merriment Social, which is in kind of the Walker's Point, Fifth Ward area. And they don't put any chairs really out on the sidewalk, but those doors open up, so it is an indoor-outdoor space. I don't think of that as a patio, though. Mm-hmm. But, you know, a place like Cloud Red in Shorewood, which is the old Shorewood Village pub, they specifically designed those windows. So, yeah, they're like doors. You can open them up. And, yeah, there's seating that just flows out onto the sidewalk. So, yeah, that to me is, that's a patio, you know?
Yeah. So we're going to go into a few different neighborhoods here. So we'll start with Bayview. And one place you have on here is one of my personal favorites, Lulu's.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Even though there's not a lot of room in back of the restaurant, per se, where most patios would be found, the outdoor is right on Kinnikinick.
Mm-hmm.
So what kind of experience does that offer people that made you include this?
To me, it's one of my favorite people watching spots because it's such an interesting and busy and lively intersection of streets. So right there is where KK and Howell kind of branch off, and Lincoln is right there. There's so many other places. There's a lot of street activity, a lot of people walking by. That little area also provides enough shade that you don't feel like you're like baking in the sun out there. But also I think that the owners have done a really nice job of kind of, even though it's right on the sidewalk there, of giving it a little bit of privacy with the plants, the way they set up the tables. You do feel like it's a bit of an extension of the restaurant because, again, they have those windows open, you know, on the north side of the restaurant is in like two storefronts, you know. What I also love about that, and you're not really outside, but there's a really great table that's right inside the restaurant, but it's next to those windows. So you're perfectly shaded, but you get all the like air. I mean, and you feel like you're outside, but you're inside the restaurant. That's a perfect table.
Sounds great. We also have Kindred on KK.
Mm-hmm.
And I like that you also pointed out what areas here are also dog friendly, because I know that's probably important to a lot of people here in Milwaukee. If you're going to go out and socialize and enjoy the outside, you want your dog to be able to do the same.
And more places are doing that. A lot of places, when I ask them, you know, they'll say, as long as it's a nice dog. You know, in other words, you know, you're not going to bring a dog that isn't good to be around other dogs or other people. That probably is not a great idea. But there is, I actually didn't include it in this because we didn't have room, but I had a whole thing on etiquette, bringing your dog to a patio. You know, make sure that you have taken it to do its duty before you sit down. you know, the best place to, for the dog to lay down is probably like, or if it's a small dog, it could be in your lap. Otherwise, it could be under the table or under your chair. You don't want to get it out in the way of other people where someone could trip over your dog. You should keep the dog on its leash as well. And so there are different things that people, I think, I like to think people are really cognizant of that, but maybe that isn't always the case. I mean, I think you're seeing more and more dogs on patios. I think it's great as long as, you know, everybody's safe and everybody's, you know, everybody's cool with that, you know, and the dog is happy to. Bring your own bowl, too, just in case they don't have a water bowl there.
Exactly.
So there are different things to think about with that.
Mm-hmm. And hopping over to one river view here is Barnacle Buds. You mentioned, you know, skip the food and just have a drink. But
yeah.
I feel like a lot of people don't explore this area of the outskirts of Bayview because it's in that weird transition area where it's edge of Bayview, kind of into Walker's Point, kind of industrial. You know, it's on that side Bay Road where people, other than the workers at the plants, like, might know where to go. So what makes Barnacle Buds a place to
it's
hunt?
Also, well, you mentioned just a little, it's off the beaten path. So you have to know where you're going to get there, which is part of the fun, you know, because, you know, you might take someone there and they're, where are you taking me? You know, you're going back behind all these industrial buildings, as you mentioned. I feel like that is one of the patios, one of the best patios if you want to feel completely transported from the city. You don't hear a lot of noise coming from the city. You can kind of peek over some of the trees and you realize, oh, there are high-rises downtown. How am I that close? You kind of feel like you're in, I don't know, like this little island out in the middle of nowhere. But it has kind of this Florida Keys feel to it. You want to sit outside. That's the whole point of this place. So it's a huge deck, picnic tables. They've got bar top tables. Everything's shaded. If you want to be in shade or not, you can be in the sun. And you're right on the river. It's just this impeccable view, and it's quiet. People are just having fun. So to me, it's, again, that feeling. There's you don't hear, like, major amounts of traffic. You don't have, like, people that are, like, you know, jogging by or biking by and they're trying to like winding around, you know, it just is this really kind of mystical feel to it.
You mentioned, you know, you want to hear, first of all, that it is quieter than the outside surroundings.
Yeah.
A little bit of restaurant noise and social noise isn't a bad thing necessarily, but if you constantly have cars zooming by, you're not exactly going for the escapist meal that you wanted. One interesting place you have listed in here is the Deer District, which is very much kind of in the hub and heart of a lot of activity
right
by the Pfizer Forum. So, I mean, technically the whole place is kind of like an outdoor entertainment, dining kind of area because it's essentially a big courtyard.
Yeah.
How does that change the game here?
Well, that's kind of the other end of the coin because you've got, that's where you really want to feel like you're part of a group of people and you want to watch people. You want to be part of a group. You don't want to feel kind of transported away from something. And you want to feel like that, you know, you're part of the energy of the city. And I don't know of another place where you feel that more than the Deer District. There are quite a number of restaurants over there now. There's Mecca, which is actually more of an entertainment complex. There's Good City Brewing, which has its own beer garden, too. There's Punch Bowl Social, which is it's a national chain, but they have their own location. They have outdoor dining. So, I mean, there's so many opportunities, different ways to sit outside, whether you're just getting a beer at Good City or you're having a meal at one of these spots, and they can just kind of move around. And again, you still feel like you're part of this scene.
Ever-growing and changing, it seems. Hasn't quite established
exactly
anything yet. Yeah,
no, so this would be like its first, and this would be like its really debut season.
Mm-hmm. One place that I think has really strong outdoor areas is the Third Ward in general. Perhaps because restaurants maybe have a little more physical space that they can inhabit, a little less closer together. What's one place in the Third Ward that is at your top of the list?
It's hard not to mention Benelux, if only because it has the rooftop patio. And they have it set up so perfectly, again, so that, you know, if you want to sit there for hours on end, you can and you are really comfortable. However, everybody's waiting for a spot up there. So I mean, like, it's such a hard spot to get a table, you know, during the summertime. So I really obviously really like that. On the river, I think Blue Bat Tequileria, I guess is what it's called.
Mm-hmm.
It's a really nice kind of double deck patio that's right on the water. And I mean, again, just a beautiful spot. as the sun is coming down. I think that's like a gorgeous spot to watch the sunset. And as you go up and down the river right there, there are other spots that have some patios like the Ale House, you know. But there's just something about Blue Bats that I really like. It's just, you know, again, it gives you that sense of being on the quiet water. You might see some kayakers go by or a little boat. And again, it's like the city winding down. So I think that one is kind of perfect, too.
When it comes to outdoor dining or patios, the thing I picture in my head and what I want is like a big secluded secret garden, you know, down to like a little wooden fence under an ivy arch, you know, that kind of takes you away from your current setting. So what are your places here in the city that have that quintessential feeling?
Cafe at the Plaza feels like that to me. It's one of my favorite spots for breakfast and lunch and brunch on the weekends. And they have a courtyard patio that you have to be inside you actually have to be in the dining room. They have doors that lead to it. So that's the only way you can get to it. It's completely enclosed, brick, you know, the sides of the brick of the building all on all the different sides, and the ivy sort of cascading down, and there's flowers back there. And again, unless you are in this building, you don't really know it's there. Nobody from the street is going to be able to see that. So you just feel like you're transported. And very much, again, this idea of being transported from, you know, away from the busyness and, you know, sounds of the city. But you're in this really quiet place. That's a spot that I really wish were open in the evening, because I think that would be really fun.
Add some lights and...
Exactly. Yeah.
If you're listening, Cafe at the Plaza.
Right. Yeah, yeah. I also had mentioned Cloud Red before, which is this little place in Shorewood. But last year they added a little patio in the back of the building, which again is kind of enclosed. They have some just kind of charming seating, nothing fancy. But again, they added some landscaping to it. So it feels, it's one of those kind of, it's sort of a secret patio. You don't know it's there unless you go inside and someone mentions it to you. So that's another spot. I'm always looking for those kind of hidden ones.
Yeah, where you have to go through the restaurant in order
to get to it.
Yeah. Another aspect that kind of adds some complexity to the whole outdoor dining definition, food trucks.
Mm-hmm.
They are growing ever more popular. You know, you have your standards that are regulars on certain streets or intersections.
Yeah.
You have food truck festivals. Do you think any patio or outdoor dining purists would want this excluded from a list of outdoor dining, or do food trucks have a rightful place?
Oh, I absolutely think they have a rightful place. I think immediately when you talk about food trucks, yeah, you mentioned all these, you know, obviously the traveling things, and there's also going to be a new food park in Walker's Point called Zocalo Food Park, where they're going to be parked all the time. But also Boone and Crockett, which is a bar in Walker's Point, that is also the home of Taco Moto, which used to be called Gypsy Taco. But there are other trucks that park there as well. I think food trucks or street food is such a major component of summer eating. It goes part and parcel with patios. So I don't think you can separate them, which is why I felt like I needed to include them as part of the story.
Well, and it seems to be a great option for restaurants to still have a food option, whether they operate that truck or not. Like,
yeah,
if they don't have the physical space or the kitchen, that they are still able to offer this to their customers.
Right. And I mean, that's what Boone and Crockett does. I mean, they aren't a restaurant, they're a bar. And so that's their way of offering food. It makes so much sense to do that. And what I like about it is that just means that there are more opportunities for new food trucks to open in the city and different kinds of food trucks.
But if people don't want to travel for food trucks at a certain location, or perhaps go to a backyard patio, they want to see the Milwaukee skyline. You know, they want a unique experience. So what are one of your favorite rooftop experiences when it comes to outdoor dining?
Well, again, the outsider at the top of the Kimpton Journeyman Hotel is amazing. It's really, there's nothing else like it. And what's nice about it, too, is that it's kind of separated into two spaces. It has a completely indoor element with a bar that, you know, you can sit inside if you're too hot out on the patio, or you just want that type of environment of being inside a bar, but you're still on the roof. And then there's the outdoor area, which has games and it has fire pits if you need it. So it's heated if it's a little bit chilly up there. And it's just it's a beautiful spot, and the view is incredible. And they have their own menu, too, of kind of like snack items, and their own cocktail menu as well. So they're pretty smart about the way they put that together. And I remember when it first opened, the first year it opened, in the middle of summer, you would go into the hotel and there would be a line at the elevator to get up there, you know, because there's only a certain number of people that they could fit on the patio up there. It's definitely a spot to try at least once. And I imagine if you try it once, you'll want to go back.
I agree. Well, there's plenty that we didn't cover and
I know,
for people
right?
to explore. Plenty to keep people busy. Probably every weekend they could explore a different thing that you included here. So Ann Christensen, thanks so much for coming in to talk about
it. Thank you.
Ann Christensen is Milwaukee Magazine's senior editor and dining critic. She wrote this month's cover story called The Ultimate Guide to Summer Dining, From Patios to Rooftops to Sidewalks. There's more info at WUWM.com. And that wraps up another week of Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North. Joy Powers and Audrey Nowakowski join me in producing Lake Effect every week with help from Ben Benversi, Zoe Munson, Cassidy Schrader, Alessandra Tejeda, and Allison Dukanovich. We also get support from the WUWM news team, including Mayan Silver, Emily Files, and Angelina Mosher-Salazar this week. Lauren Sigfusson is our digital producer. Jason Reavy is our studio engineer. And Michelle Maternowski is our managing editor. Willie Porter wrote our theme music. Thanks so much for tuning in today. I hope you'll be with us again tomorrow and Sunday afternoon at 3 for Lake Effect Weekend. It's here on Listener Supported, 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. It's 11 o'clock, so stay tuned. Fresh air is next.